The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On New Year's Day 2012, Alpha Cabeja was involved in a serious bike accident that left him unconscious on the side of the road in North London. A CT scan at the hospital revealed a severe brain injury. His doctors decided to induce coma while they worked to relieve the intense swelling in his brain. They told his family he might wake up with memory loss, unable to remember his life before the accident or even who he was. But when Cabeja finally woke up, he remembered a lot. The problem was the memories were fiction. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is a freelance writer who wrote about the man with the made-up memories for the Boston Globe Ideas section. And she's joining us from London via Skype. Linda, great to have you back with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So amnesia does seem like a likely scenario for this kind of injury, but his case was a bit different. What did he remember?
His case was definitely different. He had three very distinct memories that were sort of the big memories that came out of this incident. The first one was that his girlfriend at the time was pregnant with twins. The second one was that the day of the accident, he had been cycling from a job interview at MI6. And he was pretty sure that he got the job. He remembered the name of the man who he'd been interviewing with, a man called Michael Mitchells. And he thought definitely he got the job. So he was pretty excited about that. And he also remembered that he owned a small private plane. And he remembered that he'd been taken to the hospital in the plane.
So none of these were real.
None of these were real. And he says that he's very clear about it. They felt real to him. So he does acknowledge that people might think that it was a dream, but he says it's a memory in the same way that, you know, we all have memories. It's a real and actual memory.
So how long did he believe that these false memories, which the people around him could attest to, didn't have a plane, didn't work for MI6, not pregnant with twins, how long did he believe they were real?
He believed in the truth of his memories for about 6 months after the accident, which is quite a long time, especially when several elements of his memories were demonstrably false. You know, for example, his girlfriend hadn't had the twins yet.
But were people trying to correct him or going along with it?
People weren't. He said that people were really kind of just letting him go along with it. He said that nobody wanted to challenge him on it. And he thinks that it was largely because, you know, he's just had a massive, massive brain injury. I mean, he lost part of his brain. He had a partial lobectomy. He has a metal plate in his skull. I mean, it was a very, very serious accident. So in the weeks and months after the accident, things were already pretty jumbled up in his head. I mean, his short-term memory was gone. I had a very difficult time sort of remembering, you know, things that he was doing. He was very easily distracted. And so he kind of thought, he thinks that his family and friends weren't challenging him on it because he had a lot of other stuff going on already. And he realized, though, that these memories weren't true when he called the offices of MI6 and said that he'd had an interview there on the 1st of January. And he says that the person on the other end of the phone told him that couldn't be possible because the offices weren't open that day. And he hung up the phone and he opened his laptop and he started to search for things like this, you know, made up memories, false memories, because he started to kind of get it at that point that maybe something wasn't quite right and things started to kind of unravel.
Well, psychologists, neurologists today, how do they explain what happened? What caused his mind to construct these false memories?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things about this is that Cabeja's situation is very extreme, but we all fabricate memories all the time. This is how we make memory. So in his case, his psychologist at the time suggested that it may have been because his brain was presented with this gap of time when he was in the coma, that it filled with these sort of false connections. What happens when we make a memory is we kind of create these neural networks, these networks of neurons, where each of these little bits of memory are are stored. So, you know, there's a neuron over here that represents the feeling of tucking the ultrasound picture into a notebook, which is one of the things that he remembered doing. The neuron over there remembers the names that you've chosen and how you felt when you saw your girlfriend's belly swelling with a baby. And so all of these neurons come together to create a network. And sometimes, though, when something like a very traumatic brain injury happens, that network can be disturbed. It's disrupted. And so the connections are remade in ways that make sense to the individual but don't necessarily correspond with reality. And that's basically what happened here.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is with us. She wrote about a man who had a traumatic brain injury and woke up with well-formed but fictitious memories. His condition is not altogether uncommon and could teach neurologists and psychologists more about how the memory works. So we tend to think that our memories of our lives are accurate. I mean, we kind of record them and file them away in little file boxes and retrieve them when we need to, and that they don't change. Is this not the case? Is that not how memories work?
That's not how memories work, although you would be in definitely good company with all of the other people who believe that. There's a study in 2011 that showed that about 63% of the people surveyed believed that memory works like a video camera, that we sort of play these moments back later. But in reality, memory is a constructive process. It's a reconstructive process. When we talk about making memories, we're a lot more accurate and real than we know. When we think of a memory that we have, right, it's a sort of compressed, edited, sometimes embellished version of what may have happened. You know, so one of the examples that one of the memory researchers that I talked to gave me was like, say you were at a dinner party a couple nights ago, and you probably had a really interesting conversation with the man sitting to your left, and you probably remember what he did. You can, you know, maybe remember sort of what his hair looked like, maybe the color of his hair. And you probably remember that he was wearing a shirt. But if I were to say what color was his shirt, that might not be a memory that you have, but you know he was wearing a shirt. So in your memory, in your sort of mental picture of this dinner party, he's wearing a shirt. He's not naked. You definitely would remember that. It's things like that. We confabulate these little things all the time. We fill in details. We compress things. You know, we don't remember every minute of every day. We edit out stuff that either is just not important or is, although that's not a very good sort of rule when it comes to memory making, because obviously we forget important stuff all the time. Like, I can never remember when my wedding anniversary is. I'm really bad like that.
Yes, in couples this comes up a lot, I've noticed. So people want to believe that their memories are accurate. Is that what was kind of happening for someone like Kabeja? You know, we get invested in this idea that they're true.
Absolutely. I mean, he really did want to believe. And I think there are a number of researchers who've hit upon this notion that when you make a memory, you're in some ways telling a narrative about yourself to yourself. A memory isn't exactly accurate in the sense that it's a true recording of the events as they happened, but rather it's about what's important to you, your desires, whether those are conscious or non-conscious. It's about how you tell the story about yourself to yourself. And so Kabeja likes to think that the seeds of these memories that he had were already in his, what he calls his subconscious. You know, they were already there. You know, a number of his friends were having children. He said that twins run in his family, and he did have a girlfriend. And, you know, he did apply for a job at MI6. He did always want a plane. And so those were coming back together and knitting themselves together in ways that worked for his brain. Now, you know, he also thinks that these memories kind of helped him get better faster, that he sort of had something in some ways to look forward to, but also he was telling himself, you know, I'm going to have twins. I need to be on the exercise bike doing therapy. I need to be really working hard to get myself back to where I was. So in some ways it is definitely, you know, those memories worked for him in a way that in some ways, we make memories all the time work for ourselves.
Or not work. You know, like in the case of trauma, when people are repeating this memory that happened over and over and over to them, is there a way that doctors, researchers, scientists can use these kinds of injuries to help get a better understanding of how memory works?
They're really useful to highlight. In so extreme cases, I think, can really highlight the way we do things normally. But also, when something is sort of obviously wrong, you can kind of figure out where it got broken, what's happening. So he's definitely, you know, his memory is unusual. He's certainly not the only person who has had things like this happen. And interestingly, I think, and this may be a little bit of an aside, but one of the things that I really enjoyed hearing about in this story was that he wanted to look on these memories. He is a very positive person himself, generally. And he looks at these memories positively. But there are other people who have had similar fictional memories that tend to be from a very negative place. Mm-hmm. So people who perpetually confabulate memories that maybe their coworkers are out to get them, or they remember arguments that never happened. There are incidents of that happening. So all of these things, though, kind of come together and show how brains make memory, how we make memories, and how we make those memories to suit ourselves and our own needs less than we want them to suit sort of an accurate record of history.
Hmm. How is Kabeja doing now?
He seems to be doing really well. He's actually training for the Paralympics. He's on the Paralympic sailing team.
Wow.
He said that he got into sailing when he went to this sort of open day. There was a Paralympic event trying to get people involved in sport, and there were a number of stalls there, and he thought that it would be really fitting if he got back into cycling, given his accident. He thought it would be just the right end to his story. But he was walking past the sailing stall, and the guy noticed that he was wearing a pair of boat shoes, and so they just started having a conversation, and he got really interested in it. And since then, he's been sailing, and he's going to be hopefully on the team, on Team GB, next time around.
Well, great ending to a pretty traumatic beginning story. Linda, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie. She's a freelance writer and author of Princesses Behaving Badly. We talked with her about the article, The Man with the Made-Up Memories, which she wrote for the Boston Globe Ideas section. You'll find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Unlike other instruments, the sound of a fine acoustic violin is notoriously tricky to mimic. Even the untrained ear can typically sniff out digital imitators. Producer and violinist David Shulman looks into new technology that allows musicians to recreate the sound of a million-dollar Stradivarius at a fraction of the cost.
Guitarists make me jealous. They can buy a cheap electric guitar, run it through a pedal board, a laptop, even a phone, and sound like Jimi Hendrix. No amps, no tubes, no roadies, all thanks to some software that models vintage guitar gear digitally. This makes me jealous. I'm a violinist. I've got a nice electric violin. But however I tweak the parameters, it still sounds vaguely artificial. If they can do a Hendrix Stratocaster, why not a digital Stradivarius? Now, scientists do consider the violin one of the toughest instruments to mimic. The physics of its sound are deviously complex. Unlike the guitar, which rings on its own between each stroke of the pick, a violin's sound is constantly inflected by bowing, vibrato, and intonation. But that doesn't stop some people from trying. Like Joseph Curtin. In 2005, Curtin was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, a genius grant. He's considered one of the world's top violin makers. Many concert violinists have driven this dirt road to get to his workshop in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
David, come in.
Curtin has teamed up with University of Michigan physicist Gabi Weinreich to take a scientific approach to violin making. And they've been working quietly for several years to create a fine digital instrument.
What we're not trying to do is synthesize violin sound. That's very important. What we're trying to do is provide a musical tool for violinists, so it's real violin sound, but delivered in a different way.
Their approach draws upon the technology of convolution, a confusingly named but powerful tool used to capture precise digital sound signatures. Gabi Weinreich.
Every space in which sound can be produced has a signature. Any sound that you produce in it will be colored in a way that you can recognize.
Say a violinist plays Tchaikovsky in a studio. Run it through a convolution reverb, and it sounds like it's in LA's Disney Hall. Or you can transport the violin to an Alcatraz cell block. To capture the former prison's audio signature, an engineer had to get inside, set up mics, and record a very brief impulse of sound.
Like a popping balloon or the clapping of hands.
Measuring what happens immediately after the balloon pops lets you map the sound signature of a room. That's convolution. Weinreich and Curtin saw that this technique could also be adapted to capture the sound of great violins. In one corner of Curtin's workshop, a device lightly suspends a violin in front of a microphone. The rig lets him rotate the instrument to 12 precisely calibrated positions. He lets a tiny hammer strike the bridge.
It sounds violent because the violin makes a lot of sound when you hit it.
A sensor records the force of each tap and sends data to a laptop. Curtin has used his rig to capture the sound signatures of many fine violins.
I've measured over the years perhaps 24 Stradivari instruments, perhaps 12 Guarneri del Gesù. In some ways, it feels rather like one of those 18th century gentlemen going out on a collection expedition for butterflies or for rare plants.
Highlights from Curtin's sound collection live in the memory of the digital violin. He says the prototype won't be fully functional till later this year, but I talked him into letting me try it anyhow. Designer Alex Sobolev handed me a skeletal electric fiddle and punched up the sound signature of the famous Cathedral Stradivarius. To really judge the instrument, though, you need to compare the digital Strad and the real thing side by side.
Don't tell me which is which.
That's Professor Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music. He heads a neuroscience lab at McGill University, and he was game for my not-so-scientific comparison. First, just as a baseline, here's the raw, unfiltered sound of Curtin's digital violin, played by concert soloist Ilya Kahler. Now we'll hear two more clips. One is exactly the same signal, but filtered through the digitally captured signature of a Stradivarius. In the other clip, Kahler plays the same phrase on an actual Strad. Here's one. And here's the other.
That one sounds a little old-timey and a little processed to me. The first one sounds pretty realistic.
Actually, it's the opposite. The realistic sound came from the digital violin. The one that sounded processed was a recording of a genuine Stradivarius.
Oh.
Daniel Levitin.
It's a very good rendering. It sounds to me like a major achievement.
Levitin says he could easily imagine applications for recording and film projects. Perhaps there's a plot line about the quest to recover a long-lost Italian violin worth millions of dollars.
If you need a particular sound and you don't have access to that instrument, you're not putting a musician out of work. You're just putting an $18 million violin out of work.
Now, there's a swarm of caveats here. Just for starters, we are not comparing the instruments themselves. We are comparing recordings of them. The reverb in each is slightly different. And old Italian violins are valuable for their antique value as well as for their sound. Still, it is a shock that an electric violin could even come close to the sound of a Stradivarius. It makes you wonder, what really makes something sound human? Daniel Levitin says it comes from countless tiny interactions that are difficult to measure and predict.
It's human foibles is what it is. It's human inaccuracy that the ear is drawn to because it's so rich and full of change and delicate difference.
There is a tendency, though, to fear the lab that meddles with the sacred mysteries of life. Dr. Frankenstein's experiment was bound to end badly. What about Joseph Curtin's?
The notion that the classical violin can't be improved upon, there's an appeal in that of this one thing that stood up against the onrush of history and technology. I think that that's an icon that's born to be smashed.
Curtin thinks the digital violin will never replace the acoustic instrument, but he says we'd do better to drop the mystique and abandon the idea that science can never match the Stradivari sound.
The idea that we won't do better by putting some engineering, some science, some design into it is just silly. And why would we want it to be true? Why would we want it to simply have a few very grand instruments that are kind of legends when we could actually have fantastic musical tools that many more people could play?
So when the digital violin is ready, maybe I won't need to be jealous of electric guitarists. I'm David Shulman.
And that story came to us as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Emmett Till, the four little girls killed at the 16th Street Baptist Church. Their names are now symbols of the struggle for civil rights in America. Many others lost their lives in the fight for freedom, like Jonathan Myrick Daniels, a white seminary student from Keene, New Hampshire, killed in rural Alabama 51 years ago while trying to defend an unarmed teenage girl.
Next thing I knew, someone had pulled me from behind, and I heard a shotgun blast. And I looked, and I saw John falling. I saw John fall.
That was Ruby Sales, then a 17-year-old SNCC worker who was released from jail with Jonathan Daniels moments before he was shot by a part-time deputy in August of 1965. His death and the murderer's speedy acquittal outraged the church and the nation. But few people know the story. Rich Wallace and Sandra Neal Wallace are authors of Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights, a thorough, abundantly illustrated biography for young adults. And Rich Wallace, Sandra Neal Wallace, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. We're so thrilled to be here.
Thanks.
Really glad to have you with us. Now, Keene, New Hampshire, place you don't think of as seething racial conflict, and it had little contact with that in the South and in northern cities in the late 1960s. So how did Jonathan Daniels become involved in civil rights?
I think it was just inherent in his being the whole, from birth almost. His father was a very active physician in Keene, always serving the underserved in the community. And it's just something, Jonathan was always somebody who was always standing up for the little guy, the kid who got bullied in school, etc.
Well, so much of this history is in his life. It's photographs, it's documents, words, letters. Also, there's a countdown of his relatively few days on Earth, all leading up to this fateful day of his death. Why did you decide to use that device?
Well, we thought it was really powerful to start with what's a relatively huge number. We don't necessarily associate with our lives that we have, you know, 30,000 days left or different hours. And, you know, towards the end, when you start to see 100 days or 90 days, I think it really poses a question to the reader. What are you doing with your life? And what did Jonathan do with his life? So there's a sense of urgency towards the end of the book, whereas in the beginning, you're just kind of feeling around with your life. But I think what we really wanted to is really encourage the reader, almost a call to arms in terms of what is your activism and what you're doing with your life.
Mm. And you portray him, you know, as this young rebel, kind of skirting the rules, broke with the family religion, decided to become an Episcopalian, decided in high school to attend the Virginia Military Institute, you know, a place where Confederate flags were still flying. Why is it important for young adult readers to know about that rebel stage?
Because I think we all have that in us, and it's something that you can really connect with and see, okay, I was like him in a lot of ways. You know, a 14-year-old reader can see themselves in him, an 18-year-old reader can see themselves in him. And also, you know, through reading the book and learning about his life, see that, you know, a path, an alternate path or just a viable path towards something not just rebellious, but a product, you know, an end result that's good.
Mm. And he took a lot of deviations from that path. He was at Harvard as a fellow, I believe, when he decided to study at the seminary in Cambridge. What were you able to find about his faith and his calling?
It was, again, something that was seemed to be bred into him. I don't know that his parents were particularly religious. They were Congregationalists. But from a very early age, he was conducting sermons in his basement with his friends, and he was fascinated by ceremony, you know, incense and vestments and things like that, which his church did not have. And that was, I think, one of the things that drew him to Episcopalianism. Mm. But he was definitely devout from an early age.
Jonathan had what we could call an epiphany when he was at Harvard. You know, there was a pompous side to Jonathan. He loved to write letters, and he loved to read his own verbose letters. And I think he was really conflicted with the hypocrisy in the church, with condoning segregation or not taking a stand, and also with academia and what he was doing with his life. So he went to the Church of the Advent in Boston in his first year in Harvard and suddenly realized that he didn't want to continue his academics in Harvard, and he wanted to become a priest and be a different representative of the church. And really, when Bloody Sunday took place, he saw that chilling footage when he was at a seminary school, and that was really the tipping point for him, that he knew that he had to take action and do something.
This was March 7, 1965, when voting rights marchers were violently confronted at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So here's then SNCC chair, now Congressman John Lewis, who was there.
And then they started releasing the tear gas. To this day, I don't know how I made it back across the bridge.
That's John Lewis there speaking from Here I Am, Send Me, a documentary about Jonathan Daniels made by the Episcopal Church. After that violence, Dr. King urged white religious leaders and others to join and complete the march to Montgomery. Let's hear more.
He wanted to test, maybe he knew, but just to test whether the state of Alabama, whether the state troopers, Sheriff Clark, and the local police would use the same force and degree of brutality against these white citizens from the North as they did against poor black folks from the Black Belt of Alabama.
So Jonathan Daniels was one of those white citizens from the North heeding that call. How did you piece together his experience of the civil rights era or his civil rights activism? The letters, journals, how?
Well, I think our research could probably be considered like the third prong. There was an incredible priest by the name of Reverend John Morris, who had the foresight. He was with ESCRU, the Episcopal Society of Cultural Racial Unity, and he commissioned Jonathan, after Jonathan was in Selma for a little while, to work with him. And he had the foresight of interviewing so many people right after Jonathan's tragic death. And then after that, Larry Benequist, who was responsible for that video, took the lead and did some videos, and then we were able to really build on that research. And what was interesting is we discovered that Jonathan was an amateur photographer, and we were able to develop negatives from the photos that were in his camera after he was killed. And when we saw that narrative and what we had, we realized that our book would really have two narratives: his compelling story through those stunning photographs, and then the narrative that we created when we connected the dots.
We also came across a lot of letters that were written by Jonathan or to Jonathan from friends in Keene and elsewhere, people at the seminary. You know, so we almost had a running calendar of what he did almost day by day, because he was a prolific letter writer. We also discovered a diary that was kept by Rabbi Harold Saperstein, who spent a week with Jonathan, actually just prior to Jonathan's arrest in Lowndes County. He had spent that week working on voting rights with Jonathan, so that was almost a minute-by-minute look at where he was the last week of his life.
Wow. We're learning a little bit more about the life of Jonathan Daniels, a civil rights activist and Episcopal seminarian born in Keene, New Hampshire, and killed by a sheriff's deputy in rural Alabama in 1965. Sandra Neil Wallace and Rich Wallace are with us. They're authors of a photographic biography, Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights. They both live in Keene. I looked through some footage prompted by your book at these marches and, you know, people stuck behind barricades and struck by how many faces in the crowd were white people. I mean, we know a lot about the violence and the bigotry against African Americans, fighting racism. Maybe know less about the white sympathizers and how they were treated. What were they up against?
I will say that it was probably harder for white people to integrate into SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was headed by Lewis. And Stokely Carmichael was one of the chief leaders there as well. Stokely himself was very, very resistant to Jonathan doing anything outside of Selma because it was extremely dangerous to be a white face working for voting rights in that area at the time. But also Stokely was really a pretty staunch black nationalist. And so there was racism coming from that direction as well.
Mm-hmm. But we also learn a lot about people who were white sympathizers from the North who were killed. Were they targeted especially?
I think they were, and I think Jonathan in particular was doubly targeted because here you had a white person that was demonstrating in the front lines along with SNCC and SCLC. He could kind of vacillate between groups that were working at that time, but he also made a point of wearing a seminarian collar while he was demonstrating and while he was going door to door, convincing black farmers to have the courage to register to vote. So he really symbolized the antithesis of white Southerners who belonged to the White Citizens Council and went to the Episcopal Church on weekends. And here they were seeing Jonathan integrating their church and wearing his seminarian collar and his blue jeans and basically saying that segregation is not only wrong, but saying that as a member of the church, I am taking a physically active stand against segregation, and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting also about Jonathan, and I think why he gained so much respect, is he was able to cut through the social, cultural, and racial barriers and really get to the humanity of all of us. You know, he wasn't there as a missionary, even though he was a seminary, and he wasn't there to quote-unquote help. He was really there to lock arms with other humans to fight against an injustice.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're continuing our conversation with Sandra Neil Wallace and Rich Wallace, who wrote the book Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights. It's a biography that illuminates the life of the slain civil rights worker through interviews and public records and even photographs from Daniels' own camera that have never been made public. Many white people did join the March to Selma and other big events of the civil rights movement, and then most of them boarded buses and went home. He stayed on and went to work in Lowndes County, Alabama. I asked Sandra and Rich why he chose to work in what was then the poorest county in the United States.
Because of the need. He had done quite a bit of work in Selma. He'd worked in East Selma, helping people get social assistance. He had been working, obviously, for voting rights in Dallas County. Lowndes County, to him, was the next big challenge. That was Stokely's territory. Mm-hmm. Stokely was in charge in Lowndes County. There were 80% of the population of Lowndes County was black, primarily sharecroppers. Not one black person had voted since the Civil War.
So they far outnumbered the white population.
Absolutely, 4-1. But it was really a Klan hotbed, and it was the most, in addition to being the poorest county in America, it was the most dangerous county in America at the time. So Jonathan had to win over Stokely and Ruby Sales and others to be allowed to come along.
There were no white civil rights activists assigned there. Stokely Carmichael, as you mentioned, later changed his name to Kwame Ture. Here he is talking about Jonathan Daniels' determination to be the first.
I explained to him that we would never let him work in Lowndes County. You were too visible as a target. We're not strong enough in the county to protect you. But he was persistent. And because of persistence, always meeting, we became friends, began to say each other, but our position was firm. And his insistence was also firm.
Clip there from Here I Am, Send Me, documentary about Jonathan Daniels. our opposition, you relay some conversations of infighting. What were they fighting over?
You know, there was some bias and racism on both sides. And Jonathan, only Jonathan, I think, as a white civil rights worker who really stood by his convictions, could question Stokely Carmichael on Stokely's biases. And, you know, there was this conversation that we had been told about from another civil rights worker where Jonathan and Stokely were in this cafe. And Jonathan was saying he really wanted to be part of the voting rights movement in Lowndes, and that he felt that the reason why Stokely wouldn't let him in was because Jonathan was white. And they had this volleying of intellectual torpedo conversation going on. And really, the end result was Jonathan said that you feel that you can get killed because you're black, but I can't get killed because I'm white. And I'm really willing to put my life on the line for what I believe and for voting rights. And finally, Stokely acquiesced and agreed, and they ended up becoming really good friends. As a matter of fact, Stokely went on to say that he met so many white civil rights workers from the North who came to the South, but he only met one who he liked very much, and that was Jonathan Daniels. And when Jonathan Daniels was killed, we were told that Stokely was so upset and grief-stricken that his mother had to drive him to Jonathan Daniels' funeral.
Mm. Well, prior to that conversation that Sandra talked about, Jonathan had started seeking out Stokely. He knew where he hung out at night, and he would go and he'd, you know, have a drink in the cafe or whatever, and they'd have these lengthy discussions. And, you know, it took time, it took persistence, but it also took Stokely seeing that Jonathan wasn't really doing this. This wasn't about race for Jonathan. This was really about human rights, and that Jonathan couldn't feel free unless everybody else was.
Mm. Sandra Neil Wallace here with Rich Wallace. They are both authors of Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights. Well, it was there in Lowndes County that Jonathan worked with Ruby Sales, who was arrested and jailed with him on charges of, I think it was, what, parading without a permit or something.
Something trumped up.
In these putrid conditions for 6 days. And the book brings us back to that sort of chilling moment in that cell, August 1965, when suddenly they're told they'd be free. So help us understand what was going on there.
Well, they'd been in jail for 6 days. They'd been arrested after a small protest in a town of Fort Deposit, hauled to Haynesville, which was the bigger town and had a bigger jail, in the back of a garbage truck. Jonathan and another priest and 18 young black people, mostly teenagers, jailed in conditions that were just horrendous, and you know, no fans, no running water, toilets overflowing, just horrendous conditions for 6 days. And well aware that the previous summer in Mississippi, three freedom fighters had been let out of jail late at night and gunned down immediately by segregationists. So when they knew that nothing really was happening about them being bailed out and suddenly they were released and no one was there to meet them and they were released from the jail and kind of forced off jail property, you know, in this eerily quiet afternoon in Haynesville, Alabama, they obviously expected that something was up.
And something certainly was up. Here's Ruby Sales. She's the woman he was with and who tried to save.
Well, when we got to the store, I was in front. John was behind. John, Joyce, and Father Morris Rowe, they were behind me. And when we got to the door, I think I had walked up about one or two steps. This guy was standing in the door with a shotgun. And he told us that the store is closed. And he said, if you don't get off of this goddamn property, I'm gonna blow your damn brains out. Next thing I knew, someone had pulled me from behind, and I heard a shotgun blast. And I looked, and I saw John falling.
Ruby Sales, speaking after the murder of Jonathan Daniels. She's still an activist. Here's Tom Coleman. He's the man who was charged with manslaughter, not murder, and acquitted quickly by an all-white male jury after deliberating for 2 hours. He's speaking to a reporter here.
Let me ask you this. If you had that experience to go through all over again, would you have changed anything?
I wouldn't have changed a bit. If the same thing happened in the morning, it happened that day, I would shoot them both tomorrow.
Now, it was a local court that acquitted him. Any federal charges, anything happen there?
When Tom Coleman was acquitted, there was just a national outcry, especially with journalists that had covered the trial. Cartoonists were outraged. I think it really was the tipping point in America that they had just had enough. You know, there had been so many civil rights workers that their killers had either not had a trial or been acquitted. There was talk that maybe there could be federal charges based on civil rights crimes. That never really happened. So it was really frustrating, I think, not only for the public and journalism, but you know, people that knew Jonathan, and like John Morris, and actually Jonathan Daniels' mother, joined in a civil lawsuit with members of Lowndes County to actually sue the Lowndes County judicial system. And they succeeded incredibly within a year of getting blacks and women of all races to be on juries. At that time in 1965 in Alabama, blacks and women were prevented from serving on juries. And then there was a domino effect that other states in the South followed suit. So Jonathan's death really did change social justice in a matter of a year.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I had no idea that that was the case that started it. He's been designated a martyr by the Episcopal Church, buried in the Martyrs Chapel in Canterbury, recognized by the Episcopal Diocese in Alabama also, which I guess does an annual pilgrimage in his honor. So a man not forgotten, but we may not know that much about him. So this book opens so much. But I'm thinking you're putting this book out there when Black Lives Matter, you know, something that many people regard as the new civil rights movement or a new chapter out there. But I've heard and read white people talk about not being sure of what their role should be in supporting this. And they certainly don't have a Reverend Dr. King inviting them in. So I'm wondering, putting this out there now, is there a strategy there?
There wasn't a strategy. Unfortunately, we knew when we were researching the book that blacks in America were still being treated as second-class citizens and police brutality. So there were so many stories of hate today involving white people that what we really wanted to do was show Jonathan Daniels' story. And it's really the opposite of that, because as I mentioned, he had cut through, you know, the cultural, social, and racial barriers to the humanity in all of us. And like Black Lives Matter today, I don't think people realize that the earlier civil rights movement was fueled and propelled by young people. And we're talking about eighth graders, you know, to foot soldiers in college who put their lives on hold so that they could combat segregation and assure that every American had the right to vote.
Yeah, obviously very strong parallels between 65 and today. It's in the news every single day. It seems to be a different city every day, but there are so many conflicts going on, so much, you know, police brutality and voting rights being suppressed as well today. If you look at the cover of our book, that top photo is taken by Bob Edelman at the Berlin Wall in Selma in 1965, but it looks like it could have been taken in Baton Rouge or Baltimore or Ferguson today.
Well, Rich and Sandra, thank you so much for telling us so much about this unbelievable life of Jonathan Daniels.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
We're glad to spread the story.
Rich Wallace and Sandra Neil Wallace are authors of Blood Brother, Jonathan Daniels and His Sacrifice for Civil Rights. You can find more on their book for young adult readers and more on the life of Jonathan Daniels, a civil rights activist and Episcopal seminarian from Keene, New Hampshire, at wordofmouthradio.org. And we want to let you know that Sandra and Rich will be signing copies of Blood Brother at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Thursday, September 29th at 5:30. You can also find details on that reading at wordofmouthradio.org. You can listen to this story again. You can pass it along to your family, friends, kids, on Facebook or Twitter or other social media. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org to find the link. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.